And it's another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you want to know more about Hope, you can at investinghope.com. If you want to listen to the show, you certainly can live every single Tuesday afternoon at 5 on WRJZ. That is 620 a.m. And then 102.5 FM. Mine just went blank. And so you can do that if you're listening live, you're driving in your car. We certainly would welcome that. If you're not on the road during that time or not able to listen, you can find this show at investinghope.com. You can also find it on iTunes or Google Play, TuneIn app, wherever podcasts are found. You can listen to this while you mow your yard. That's where I get a lot of listening done. Not of my own podcast. That would be arrogant. I mean, I do listen to my podcast, but there's other things that I listen to as well while I'm mowing the yard. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a couple things. There's a great article over at Public Discourse about pro-lifers and kind of an answer, a response article to a piece that was put in, that was written by Michael Ware a couple weeks ago concerning Democrats and being pro-life. And so we're going to walk through that a little bit. I think it's a worthwhile for us to listen. It's a long read, but I do think it's important that you hear a rebuttal to that and hear the side of someone that says, look, I lean left on a number of issues, but when it comes to life, I'm pro-life. And so how do we work through that? How do we have those discussions? And I think that's important. So we're going to start there. Then I'm going to shift a little bit when we come back from our first break and talk about purity culture. And the reason I'm going to talk about that, if you're familiar with a book that was written a few years back called I Kiss Dating Goodbye, and it was elevating purity culture and saving yourself from marriage. And in that particular case, the fellow that wrote the book went a little bit further and said, look, I'm not dating anyone that I'm not prepared to marry or anything like that. We're going to walk through that a little bit. He made the news again. Joshua Harris made the news again this week as he announced not only does he, I guess, in effect, retract everything that he's ever written. He also, his marriage is ending. He's getting a divorce with his wife. And he also came out over the weekend and said, not only all of that, but also I am walking away from Christianity. And he's claiming that he's no longer a Christian. That's not who he is. He's also accepting and changing his views when it comes to homosexuality in the LGBT community. And so we're going to look at that. David French has a great article over at National Review that kind of walks through that. And I'm going to talk about it from a standpoint of a lot of people are seeing this and other things and going, kind of wanting to throw everything out when it comes to purity culture. And I want to talk to you about that. But let's start with the article at Public Discourse, which is a great piece written by Colin Smothers. And it's entitled Pro-Lifers Should Be Wary of Empty Pro-Life Rhetoric. So 50 million. This is how he starts. 50 million. That's the number of innocent American babies aborted, starved, poisoned, or dismembered, perhaps even sold for parts since the infamous Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. That is 10 times as many deaths as were lost in the Holocaust. America has suffered 2.8 million war casualties since its founding, a number that includes every war America has fought to date. For every one American lost to war since 1775, nearly 18 babies have been aborted since the procedure was legalized in America in 1973. I cite these mind-boggling statistics up front to put in perspective the calculating tone of the recent New York Times op-ed from Michael Ware, provocatively titled, Democrats shouldn't be so certain about abortion. Ware cautions the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates against using outlandish pro-abortion rhetoric that puts them out of step with the majority of American voters. Ware attempts to establish his authority by reminding the reader that he served in President Barack Obama's White House and on both of his victorious presidential campaigns. Ware highlights his success in leading religious outreach for Obama's re-election campaign in particular, where he helped him overcome attacks that he was pro-abortion. Mr. Ware currently serves as chief strategist for the AND campaign and is a self-styled pro-life Democrat. And I'll just let you know, a lot of the conferences I go to with the ERLC, with pro-life conferences, the Gospel Coalition, you'll read from Michael Ware. You'll hear a lot about Michael Ware. I've actually reached out to him to see if we can get him on the show. Hopefully I'll be having him on in the near future to talk about this, the mindset of what he would call himself a pro-life Democrat. And the article continues, I read Ware's column with great interest, in part because I wanted to be convinced that the label, quote, pro-life Democrat, end quote, is not a political oxymoron. I wanted to know what a Democrat leading light who has been given a platform by many evangelical organizations of late might propose to his party as a way to persuade more pro-life voters to pull the lever for Democrats. Ware's advice goes like this. And Collins says, I was a bit amazed then, but not altogether surprised to read Ware's summary advice on abortion to the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates. Advice he recommends as basically Mr. Obama's approach. And this is fitting, too, because tonight is the first phase of the Democratic debate that will continue on tomorrow night. And so this is all relevant to what's going on in the country. And so Ware says this, support and defend Roe v. Wade, but express moral reservations about abortion itself. Offer openness to additional restrictions on abortion, including a ban on late-term abortions with limited exceptions, and call for a set of policies with the purpose of reducing the abortion rate in America, such as paid family leave, workplace protections for parents and pregnant women, increase access to birth control, and strengthen social safety net. There it is. Ware's recommendation for the Democratic candidates is to be less extreme on abortion. And so it's important. I want to break off from the article for just a second. If you're going to accept and be okay, this is what Ware said, support and defend Roe v. Wade. Okay, if you're going to support and defend Roe v. Wade and the decision that was made in 1973, then why not be extreme? I mean, that's a serious question. I'm not trying to start arguments. That's a serious question. If you were okay with the decision of Roe v. Wade that legalized abortion in this country, then why not be extreme? If it's okay in the first and the second trimester, why not the third trimester? If it's okay in the first and second trimester, why not even in botched abortions let the child just get comfortable and slowly lose its life? If you're okay with Roe v. Wade and you're okay with abortion in the first and second trimester, why not be okay with the selling of body parts of these aborted babies? Those are serious questions that need to be wrestled with for those that would support Roe v. Wade. And so Colin goes further. He says, first, Ware tells Democratic candidates to support and defend Roe v. Wade. This is curious advice coming from someone who calls himself pro-life. Roe v. Wade has enabled the legal killing of over 50 million human beings since 1973. Yet Ware calls on politicians to support and defend it. Shouldn't anyone who claims the pro-life label reject the outrageous legal reasoning in Roe and its moral consequences? How is counseling politicians to support and defend Roe, the legal bedrock on which America's abortion regime is built? Anything but a pro-abortion stance. Second, he says, candidates should express moral reservations about abortion itself. How is it consistent to say that it is wrong to kill unborn human beings, but that it ought to be legal to do so? This sounds more like political calculation than pro-life principle, and that is the problem. That is certainly the problem. Elsewhere, in an article for Politico magazine, Ware describes exactly what such openness to additional restriction really looks like. Ware says this, in President Obama's entire time in office, the White House did not propose one restriction on abortion, even though the president stated he was, quote, completely supportive of a ban on late-term abortions, end quote, in the final presidential debate in 2008, and he repeated his openness to restrictions on abortion throughout the 2008 campaign. So here we go. Just because you say you're open to it, just because you say you're open to it, doesn't mean that you're going to do anything about it. That's where we are currently. And frankly, this is something that both sides of the aisle needs to hear. We have one side of the aisle that, it seems to me, spends a lot of time on the campaign trail saying they're pro-life, saying we need to restrict abortion, saying we need to defund Planned Parenthood, saying we need to do all of these things. And yet we still find ourselves giving $500 million to the abortion giant. We still find ourselves with abortion clinics across this country that are not meeting the basic requirements of a medical facility. We still find ourselves having places like Kermit Gosnell's clinic in Philadelphia that was allowed to operate for 20 plus years, not only with babies dying, but moms dying. Go read that story. 15-year-olds working in there, giving out prescriptions to people. Body parts floating in jars when the cops finally decided to go in. So it's one thing to say, look, personally, I'm pro-life, but I don't want to go any further than that. It's one thing to say, look, support Roe v. Wade, but call for late-term restrictions. Call for third trimester abortion restrictions. You see, if I'm a pro-choicer, I'm hearing this language and I'm going, why? Why would I do that? If I support Roe v. Wade, I support it all the way through. And as a pro-lifer, I'm going, if I'm against Roe v. Wade and I'm against that decision and I believe that decision doesn't line up with our Constitution and I'm against abortion, then I'm against abortion in the beginning and in the end and in the middle. I'm against abortion in the first, in the second, and in the third trimester. And if you try to have an abortion and it's botched and the baby survives, that baby deserves protection under the law. It really is a black and white. There's no gray area here. But yet we want to tiptoe around it. We want one side to campaign on it and raise money on it, but never really do anything with the pro-life stance that they claim to have. And then we have another side that is completely said no restrictions at any point for any reason. I mean, listen to the platform of one of the largest, the some would say the largest political party in the country. This is their platform. We will continue to oppose and seek to overturn federal and state laws and policies that impede a woman's access to abortion, including by repealing the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment, which says taxpayer dollars should not go toward abortion. So they want to repeal that. They go further. We will appoint judges who defend the constitutional principles of liberty and equality for all and would protect a woman's right to safe and legal abortion. We will support sexual and reproductive health and rights around the globe, in addition to expanding the availability of affordable family planning information and contraceptive supplies. We believe that safe abortion must be part of the comprehensive maternal and women's health care and included as part of America's global health programming. Therefore, we support the repeal of harmful restrictions that obstruct women's access to healthcare information and services, including the, quote, global gag rule and the Helms Amendment that bars American assistance to provide safe legal abortion throughout the developing world. So the party platform is, did you hear that last part? Which includes, we want to repeal laws that are in place so that we can help provide safe legal abortion throughout the developing world. So it's not enough for the DNC in this country to say we want to have abortion on demand in this country. They want to go even further and say we want your tax dollars to pay for abortion here, and we want your tax dollars to pay for abortion around the world. Since 1973, somewhere between 50 and 60 million abortions have occurred inside the walls of this country. Around the world, that number is astronomical. You're looking at like 40 million maybe around the world every single year. And we have folks that would say, not only should we have it legal and we should pay for it in America, but our funds should help provide abortion across the globe. That's a problem. We'll be back. That distance, even if I wanted to, you came running after me when anybody else would have turned and left me at my worst. So as we finish up that first segment, I just want to say this. Look, the article's great. It's over at thepublicdiscourse.com. You can find it there. But I love the way Colin ends the article. He says, if your messaging to pro-life voters begins with, quote, support Roe, end quote, and ends with, quote, heartbeat bills are extreme, end quote, then I don't think you understand pro-life voters. And I hope that pro-life voters won't be taken in by the deceptive messaging in that narrative. So think about that. You can't out of one side of your mouth say, look, we support Roe. And then out of the other side of your mouth say, heartbeat bills are extreme. And what Tennessee has tried to do, what Alabama's tried to do, what Louisiana's tried to do, what Ohio has tried to do, what and all these other states have tried to do is extreme. Well, guess what? That's not a pro-life stance. It's not. Supporting Roe and the decision that was made in 1973 is not a pro-life stance. Period. And so there is no gray area there. And I think it's important that as we watch these debates, as we have these conversations, all of that, all I'm saying is pay attention to the words and to the rhetoric from both sides. Hold accountable those that are leading. If they're out there campaigning and they're saying, look, I'm pro-life and I'm going to fight for the lives of the unborn and I'm going to fight to defund the largest abortion giant in this country, and then they don't do it, hold them accountable to that. And then if you support another side and they're saying, look, it's no longer safe, legal, or rare, but it's anytime, anywhere, and for any reason, hold them accountable for that. It's very important that we do that. And so thepublicdiscourse.com, I would encourage you to go read that piece. And so as we shift gears a little bit now, I want to get into purity culture, and I want to get into, hey, saving yourself for marriage. And maybe some folks listening to this are going, look, I've been married for a long time. Why are we talking about this? Well, maybe you have kids or grandkids. And how do we have this conversation? I wore a True Love Waits ring for a long time. When my wife and I dated, and she wore a True Love Waits ring. And when I was in college and people saw that ring, they thought I was weird and they didn't really understand it. But I would explain it to them. And so I never read the book that I'm about to discuss. But I think it's important we understand what's going on here. So I want to read what David French wrote over at the National Review called Whether Evangelical Purity Culture, Thoughts on the Legacy of a Lost Pastor. And so it's an important article that we look at. And then after I go through what David French wrote, I want to talk about the purity culture kind of in general and why it's important that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't get rid of everything just because someone wrote a book that we don't agree with. And so here's what French had to say. Repenting of his past legalism, Joshua Harris is leaving the faith to which he did unintentional but great harm. If you don't live in evangelical world, you probably missed this news. An influential evangelical author and pastor named Joshua Harris announced on Saturday that he was in the process of what he called deconstruction. His statement was clear, quote, by all the measurements I have for defining a Christian, I am not a Christian, end quote. He apologized to the LGBT community for not affirming gay marriage and for the ways that his writing and speaking, quote, contributed to a culture of exclusion and bigotry, end quote. For Christians, it's a sad statement, but it's also full of real integrity. Rather than try to jam Christianity into his evolving worldview, he respects orthodoxy by opting out. Harris burst into prominence as a young Christian with every author's dream, a giant, influential first book bestseller. It was called I Kissed Dating Goodbye, and it sold almost 1 million copies. If anything, however, the sales numbers understated its influence. It was part of the foundation of evangelical purity culture, and it revolutionized parenting and dating for countless Christian parents and families. French says, I remember it well. I was youth pastor for a few memorable months at the height of the courtship craze. The year was 1998. I was a youth volunteer at a small church in Georgetown, Kentucky, when our youth pastor left. Until we could find a new youth pastor, I was in charge. I preached the youth service every week. I led the youth Sunday school, and I led the youth prayer groups. I was also a commercial litigator in a big law firm, and suddenly I had two full-time jobs. It was one of the best times of my life. But we also had a problem. The youth ministry had gone all in on purity culture. The previous youth pastor had even declared, quote, no date 98, end quote, placing a moratorium on every kid in the youth group, not even a single date for the entire year. When it came to relationships, it would be, quote, courtship, end quote, tersely defined as parental supervised visits and outings, or nothing. This wasn't wanton repression or cruelty. Many parents had entered adulthood wounded by past broken relationships. They regretted the mistakes of their youth and desperately wanted their kids to avoid similar heartbreak. Also, and this is crucial for understanding purity culture, they fervently believed in a specific earthly reward for their child's youthful obedience. Courtship represented the best method of ensuring a healthy, sexually vibrant marriage to a faithful spouse. This is what writer Caitlin Beatty called the sexual prosperity gospel. An if-then transactional relationship with God that manufactures a series of promises from Scripture and then creates a form of Christian entitlement and expectation. Quote, I did what you asked, Lord, now may I see my reward, end quote. Beatty's critique is well taken, and it's certainly true that purity culture built a series of often wildly unrealistic expectations about the marriage relationship that awaited kids who courted. But I think it did something even darker. In its effect, its intent, it reversed the gospel message, teaching Christian kids that they risk being defined by their sins, not by Christ. It worked like this. Sexual sin stained young persons, even if Christ forgave them. They would walk into marriage diminished in some crucial ways. The white dress fundamentally was a lie, and the message wasn't confined to sexuality. Did you drink? Did you smoke a joint? Each one of those things altered a person's self-definition. They were no longer, quote, pure, end quote. They could never be, quote, pure again. All too many times I saw the despair. A young person would come to me and say, I screwed up. They would really mean I'm ruined. Their storybook dreams were dead. A 17-year-old with, God willing, 70 years of life ahead of them would approach me carrying the awful burden of thinking that he had defined his life forever. He was no longer and never would be the person he wanted to be. Sometimes the despair would trigger wild rebellion. If they're ruined, then why should they care about obedience? There are two states of being, virgin or not, teetotaler or not. And if you're not, then you might as well indulge yourself. Other times, the despair would trigger constant nagging guilt and regret. A girl would walk down the aisle to marry a man who loved God and loved her, and she'd feel a shadow on her soul. In point of fact, the gospel message rests first on bad news, then on good news. The bad news is simple. You were never pure. It's not as if sex or drink or drugs represent the demarcation line between righteous and unrighteous. They are not and were never the special sins that created particularly acute separation from God. Yes, they could have profound earthly consequences, but they did not create unique spiritual separation. The good news is that from the moment of the confession of faith, believers are not defined by their sin. They're not defined even by their own meager virtues. They're defined by Christ. Moreover, they find that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose, as Scripture says. This does not by any stretch mean that past sins wasn't sin. One of my best friends is an 11-year sober addict who did dreadful things during his worst days. But it does mean that their past now gives them a unique ability to reach suffering people. Their terrible stories and past pain have been redeemed, transformed into instruments of grace and mercy. One of my first acts as youth pastor was to lift the ban on dating. Ending legalism is not the same thing as sanctioning sin, and I have no idea if there was more or less extramarital sex as a result of the dating ban or the purity rings. But it was incumbent upon me, in the limited time that I had in leadership, to tell the truth, and the truth was that legalism is its own kind of sin. To create burdens where Christ did not is an act of arrogance. It's deeply harmful, and sadly, it's a way of life in all too many Christian churches. French ends with this. Harris has famously repented of his past legalism, and that makes his departure from the faith particularly poignant. He helped define young people by their sin, and then he left. He separated from his wife, and he rejected Christianity itself. He is like an arsonist who flees the burning house rather than helping fight the fire he helped ignite. I'm sad to see him go. I'm sadder still to see the pain he caused when he was present. Okay, so that's a lot to take in. Look, when I hear purity culture, when I hear true love waits, when I wore that ring, to me, I didn't wear that ring. I wasn't planning on saving myself for my future wife in the hopes that I was going to have a great marriage and that God was going to somehow reward me with great marriage and great sex for the rest of my life if I saved myself for my spouse. That wasn't the mindset, but clearly that was the mindset of some folks. And we're going to dive into that when we come back and look at purity culture and say, okay, what can we take from, what are the good things? What's the ideal scenario? What did God have for us when we talk about these types of relationships? We'll be back. 'Cause I'm just a nobody, trying to tell everybody all about somebody who saved my soul. Ever since you rescued me, you gave my heart a song to sing. I'm living for the world to see, nobody but Jesus. I'm living for the world. So as we talk about the purity culture, and this is really, you know, this was really heavy kind of in the, I guess, late 90s, early 2000s. When I was coming up in youth group, it was a big deal. But look, there were some folks that were teaching it very legalistic, meaning save yourself from marriage. And if you do save yourself from marriage, you're going to have an amazing marriage. The sex is going to be great. And you don't have to worry about anything. Well, that is a form of the prosperity gospel. That is a form of, hey, if I do these certain things, God's going to reward me. That's like saying, well, if I pray more, I won't get cancer. Yeah, it's not going to happen. That's not how it works in a post-Genesis 3 world. And so what we know is we live in a post-Genesis 3 world, which means even if we save ourselves for our spouse, and that's the only person we've ever laid down with, that we're still broken people. We still have other baggage. We still have other sins. The marriage still may fail. And so that's the truth of the matter. But what my fear is a lot of people, my generation, people that are, you know, 30 to 35 years old, especially are looking at this and going, I was really harmed and damaged by the purity culture. And now we need to get rid of all that. And so you have people walking away. You have a pastor looking at his marriage and going, I don't understand. Why is my marriage not working? I did everything I was supposed to do. I saved myself. I kissed dating goodbye. I did everything I was supposed to do. And my marriage is failing. And Joshua Harris's answer is, so I'm going to tap out. I'm done. Not just with the marriage, but with all of it. And so now is not the time to dump on him. But it is a time to reflect. Do we see God as some Santa Claus in the sky? That if we're good, we'll get presents. Or is Jesus enough? That's a tough question. John Piper posed it this way. He said, if you got everything that heaven has to offer, the mansions, the golden roads, all everything that we read about heaven, if you got all of that, but no Jesus, would you still want it? What's our honest answer to that? If you got everything, but no Jesus, would you still want it? You see, Scripture says in Genesis 2, verse 24, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So right there, before the fall occurs, sex is there. How else is man and woman going to become one flesh? And so we know it was created to be good. Certainly. But it was created to be in the relationship of a husband and a wife. Well, then Genesis 3 happens, and what goes on? Well, then Adam and Eve go, whoa, you're naked, I'm naked. That's weird. Why are we naked? Why do we have shame here? And then what? This is the thing that irks me, is that some say the purity culture created so much shame, so much guilt, and then we have this in our mind that God is going to hate us. God is going to leave us. God is going to take everything away from us if we stumble and fall. If that is your mindset, then you are completely ignoring Genesis 3. Adam and Eve, the first two humans on the planet, had everything at their disposal. Everything was good. Adam had his woman. Eve had her man. They were told to not do one thing. And they ate of the apple. Sin comes into the earth. What could have happened if we take the mindset of, well, God is going to then crush it. What could have happened is God steps into the garden and says, okay, y'all are done. Zap, you're done. I'm going to start over. What did God do? He says, I'm going to send someone. And it's going to be your offspring, and it's going to crush the head of this serpent. The serpent's going to bite the heel, but ultimately the serpent's head is going to be crushed. Oh, and I see that y'all are naked now. And I see that you notice that you're naked now. So what did God do right there in the garden? An animal was sacrificed. An innocent blood had to be sacrificed. And he covered the shame and the guilt and the sin of the first man and woman, which was simply a foreshadowing of what was to come at Calvary. And so now I have four kids. My wife and I wore the True Love Waits rings. We weren't always perfect growing up, but we saved ourselves for each other. Has our marriage been amazing the whole time? There's no. And I'm sure my wife would say this. I would assume she would say the same thing. Our kids aren't always great. But we have four kids. So now what do I do as my oldest is 8? When we start having that conversation, a conversation, mind you, that I still have yet to have with my parents on what sex is, but apparently we figured it out. And so as we start to have these conversations, does that mean I'm going to tell my children, my son, my daughters, not to stay pure for their spouse? Of course not. But we're not going to bring guilt and shame. We're simply going to say, here's how God created it. Here's why it was created. But just because you're saving yourself for a spouse doesn't necessarily mean you will even have a spouse one day. Just because you're saving yourself for that spouse doesn't mean that you're going to have it all figured out and everything's going to be hunky-dory and amazing and you're going to have the greatest marriage this planet has ever seen. No, it doesn't mean that. Why? Because you're fallen, broken humans. But it doesn't mean we don't strive for that. Look, I'm a teetotaler when it comes to alcohol. For a long time, that was a legalist thing. Not necessarily because I thought, well, look, if I don't drink, God's going to reward me somehow. I'm a teetotaler. I don't want to even go down that path. I don't want my children to go down that path. But it's not about shame and guilt. It's about what could that do to me? What could that do to my family? What if I really liked it? What if it became a problem? What if it became an addiction? I don't know how my body would respond to that. I don't know how my mind would respond to that. And so as you're reading these articles about people stepping away, and we've seen it over the last 5 years, we've seen a lot of pastors fall from their positions, marriages crumble, kids leave the faith. Look, no one said this was going to be easy. When Jesus was looking at the disciples and says, I want you to leave all of that and follow me, no one said, hey, and it's going to be easy. Jesus knew when he was saying to them, drop your nets now and follow me. Drop everything you've worked for and follow me. Jesus knew 3 years from there, he was going to be on a cross in Calvary. He knew that. When he looked at the rich young ruler and he said, in order for you to follow me, you have to leave all that behind. It wasn't saying that all rich people are going to hell. He's simply saying, that is your idol. Can you put your idol down and follow me? And what we've done as a culture in 2019 is sex and our gender and our sexuality has become our idol. It defines us. Now you go up to someone and you say, hey, how are you? My name is so-and-so. You're going to, if there's a good possibility, they're going to say, well, I'm a homosexual and my name is this. Why? Because that's become their identity. And so all I'm saying is I'm cautioning us, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Look, there was some destruction that occurred because of this book and because of purity culture at some level. And we need to recognize that. And we don't need to be raising up just kids that follow rules. We need to be raising up kids that love Jesus and understand the gospel. And it is that love of the gospel, that love of Jesus, that then drives them to save themselves for marriage. Not because they think they're going to get some kind of reward when it's all said and done, but because the love of the one that gave his life up for us, the mediator that came and took the cross in our place. It is that love that makes us then want to do the things that are righteous, do the right things, love our spouses, love our children, put things in the proper order. And then we get to enjoy the beautiful things that God created. We'll be back. Yeah. So I didn't know today that I was going to talk about purity culture. I talked with Bob Bell this morning on his show, and he was asking me, what are you going to talk about? And I was like, the fundamental right to life. And then, I read some more today and thought, you know what, we're going to talk about purity culture and sex and stuff. And so that's what we got into. So hopefully that is helpful, though. As I know, even with me, I mean, with four children, we're trying to figure out how those conversations are going to go. And it's hard for parents. We want our kids to be good. We want them to do the right thing. We don't want to create a bunch of little legalists that are out there doing good just for good sake. But we also don't want to go the other way. You know, even Paul says, you know, just because there's grace, it doesn't mean go and sin all the more. I've referenced John Piper already once today, but he used to give this analogy. He said, if I came home to my wife, his wife's Noelle, if he came home to Noel and he came home to his wife and he had flowers and she said, hey, John, what are the flowers for? And he just looked at her and said, look, you know, we've been married for a while. They were on sale at the gas station. Enjoy them. Now, he still brought flowers to his wife, but he would be doing it out of I have to, out of necessity. But if he came home with flowers on some random day and he walked in the house and Noel said, what are the flowers for? And he said, the last 30 years have been the best years of my life. We've had our ups and downs, but every day with you is a better day. And I love you that much. That's why I brought these flowers. Well, that's doing it out of love of another and out of the love that another has for you. So the reason why we should save ourselves for marriage, the reason why we should try to fight sin with everything we have is out of reverence for the Creator. Out of a God that walked in the garden and in the midst of the worst day this planet had ever seen, and said, I'm going to cover your sin. Out of reverence for a God that said, I know y'all can't fix this on your own, I'm going to send a mediator. Out of reverence for a Jesus that went to a cross to save us. That is why. That is why we save ourselves from marriage. That is why we do the right thing. That is why we love our neighbor. Out of reverence for the one that loved us. It's the same thing of the parable where the king forgives the debt of a servant. He didn't deserve to have that debt forgiven, but he did because he, out of care and grace. And then that servant walks out of the building and sees someone that owes him money, and he throws him in jail. You see, the mindset isn't what can I get out of this. The mindset is, out of reverence for the one that created me, the one that saved me, the one that takes my sins, out of reverence for him, I'm going to, the fruit of my, or the work is going to produce the fruit that it needs to produce, because I'm doing these things, I'm making decisions and choices out of reverence for the one that created me, for the one that saved my soul. So when you hear about purity culture, it isn't about, I'm going to save myself in order that I might be rewarded. Because the mindset has to be, I'm going to save myself even if I don't have a spouse one day. I'm going to still save myself. Why? Because that's the way God intended it. That's not easy. But it's the process. And it's the love of the one that created us and the one that saved our soul. I'll talk to you next week.